Oh, hi. I'm sorry, that sounds like the tone of a man who's been talking to his cats all day. And you deserve better. Ah, hello. Welcome back to the podcast. This is Brett. What you're going to hear today is a repost, my third appearance on the Renegade Variety Hour. Really like working with these guys, Carlos and Taryn. And the first show we did together is in the podcast feed. The second one was not, but it's on the website. It's at the top of the website right now at schoolsucksproject.com. And we had a wonderful conversation, but it was long and meandering, and sort of the topics were off message for what I like to put into the podcast feed. But if you have the time, I recommend you either watch the video or download the MP3. So this third discussion the three of us had was at Porkfest, and Carlos and Taryn had just been sitting in the audience of a panel, Conspiracy Theorists versus Skeptics. So that generated some interesting discussion. We talk about several topics here. In fact, a young man, 15-year-old, unschooler, named Jeff Maxim, who is in New Hampshire right now staying with Dana Martin and coming to stay with me in just a couple of days. So you'll hear the two of us doing some content together. We might actually do a whole bunch of stuff Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week. He's in this conversation as well. He jumps in maybe like the 15-20 minute mark, so you can be introduced to him here. So that's it. I'm just buying myself some time because I'm working on a few things right now. A lot of stuff in the pipe. Is that a saying? It sounds like it could be interpreted a number of different ways. Pipeline. A lot of stuff in the pipeline. All right. Talk to you soon.
Hey, everyone. This is Carlos Morales of the Renegade Variety Hour. Recently, myself and Taryn Harris were able to go to Porkfest in Lancaster, New Hampshire, which is a rather large festival. I think around 1,500 libertarians were there, where there's a number of lectures from David Friedman, Mayor Ruart, Bob Murphy, and we were able to meet some great libertarians in person, like Brett Vinat and Jeff Maxim, which was just, you know, fantastic. He's of skepticalyouth.tumblr.com, and of course, Brett from schoolsucksproject.com. The following is an interview with both of them. Jeff ends up coming in at about the 22-minute mark. We had to do a little bit of editing due to background noises. So I hope you all enjoy. And remember to check us out at therenegadevarietyhour.com and to subscribe on iTunes. This whole conference has been pretty interesting in regards to a number of different subjects being brought up. You know,
yeah.
I mean, a lot of the times what they're talking about is, how are we going to get the liberty movement together? How are we going to get the liberty movement together? How to not splinter off each other? So a lot of it's like how to make an individualist perspective collectivistic.
We're all coming together at the same time. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I think there's going to be a lot of that, and it's necessary because I think that PR is very important.
Yeah.
You know? And you also remember you have a public that is, for the most part, like most people, when they hear about this, they are immediately on not open ears and minds to new ideas. They're on a search for how to discredit it so they can go back to, you know, believing whatever makes them comfortable. So, I mean, I know that sounds cynical, but people will, you see when critics come along to anything, they try to latch on to something that's going to make them feel okay about just dismissing it. So PR is very important. And, you know, there's kind of three, well, at the very least, two very distinct sort of, I don't want to call them sects, because that makes it sound religious, but you have the Keen people in Free Keen, which is very much focused around civil disobedience, and you have political people in Concord, and they've been at odds with each other for years over the best method to, you know, do outreach and to bring new people into these ideas. So that is, I think, just natural, that kind of conflict is natural to an individualist libertarian movement. You know, people in the past have like complained about Porkfest, this went wrong or this wasn't right. And like,
yeah,
you know, there was a group of people once who said, we're going to do this and it's going to be perfect for everybody. But they weren't libertarians. You know? So I think that's just part of it. And I think that dialogue is good. And I think that even though sometimes disagreements are frustrating and they feel like, as a movement or as trying to push ideas forward, it leads to spinning wheels a little bit. It's also it's important to compare that to other political ideologies where there is virtually no disagreement.
you know, that people move like a flock, wherever they're told, wherever they're led. So I think that the discord that is in what's going on here is very healthy. And, you know, sometimes I understand how people are annoyed by it, especially when people have, you know, invested all this time and money and resources into some political action or getting some bill passed. And then their perception is that somebody in Keene ruins it by standing in front of a cop car or, you know, I don't agree with that. And I can see, I understand the merits and the downsides to both approaches, and I kind of am not really involved in either one. I just happen to be in New Hampshire doing my thing, you know, and I don't see myself as part of a movement.
Oh, really?
I don't I don't like movements. Movements sound collectivistic, and a lot of people, a lot of Free Staters that you'll talk to, don't like that language.
Really?
Right. The language of movement? No, because movement sounds flockish, you know?
It does.
I suppose, yeah.
So the I'm not in any way a spokesperson for the Free State, but the idea was, you know, come to New Hampshire and get involved how you want to get involved. And there's some expectation that you're going to be at odds with people when you do that, but, you know, it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
Yeah,
to have.
Yeah. No,
yeah, I think the majority of what I've heard was pretty positive so far in. I mean, I listened to some people who were from Connacht, and they did talk about Keene, and they described it as being antagonistic. But even when they said that Keene activists are antagonistic, it still wasn't this deep resentment towards individuals living in Keene and doing what they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was still sort of an acceptance of we're all looking to reach the same goal.
Right.
You know, the means by which we accomplish it, sure, we disagree on, but there wasn't like this deep resentment.
Right. Yeah. 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 I mean, these people are all friends, you know?
Yeah. And that has been really refreshing to see. Another kind of topic that I wanted to discuss, though, was there was a discussion today in regards to the conspiracy versus skeptic.
Yeah. Which I don't think you're as big of a fan of. I enjoyed the conversation. I did. You know, I think they both disagree, but there's still this, I guess what I appreciate is that there's this common goal to try to intellectually better themselves.
Well, know? It was and interesting, really, though, because they picked a federal agent to be the anti-conspiracy guy, which is pretty much the worst thing you could ever do in front of a group of conspiracy theorists.
Yeah. Who is the federal agent?
He works for it's a contracting firm
for software development.
For software development that contracts to the federal government. And so, you know, when you got a guy like that coming in, who no one knows who that guy is, like he's not very known at all. And then he comes in and goes like, no, you know, you conspiracy theory guys, you know, you're not even paying attention to what's
– I'm not sure how you
– So what were the conspiracies discussed?
Well, so people would raise your hand and then you would say which kind of thing you would get into. I raised my hand and said vaccinations, of course, because that's my topic du jour. And what I was saddened by was that the anti-conspiracy guy had no idea regarding the subject, which is kind of bad when it comes to, you know, if you're in a conspiracy debate, you kind of want to know the main conspiracies that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the pro-conspiracy guy brought up a lot of – I'm going to bring up one fact. I'm going to bring up another fact. Therefore, all this after the fact.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that a lot of people who wind up either completely dismissing because, I mean, a lot of these conspiracies have an element of truth to them, if not several elements of truth to them, even to maybe some of the more ridiculous sounding ones and some of the ones that people want to dismiss. Because did we talk about eugenics the last time I was on the show?
Yeah.
Super real thing, like really real, lots. But I think that people either say, yes, yeah, I'm totally into this. You know, they're trying to reduce the population of the world by 85% sold. And other people say, that's the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard in my life. You know, like that's so get your head out of your ass and, you know, take off the tinfoil hat. But conspiracies, I think, have nuances and phases that people often don't recognize. So in the beginning, there's ideation, right, where maybe there's a small group of people who don't have good intentions, who do formulate some kind of plan, and maybe they have a story that they tell themselves, and this could be like, you know, the Fabian Socialists, which is often called the Open Conspiracy, which is a group of people that this began in Britain in the latter half of the 1800s, and like right at the end of the 1800s anyway, and eventually like Cecil Rhodes and the Round Table groups and the Council on Foreign Relations, and there's like a consistent lineage of influence from Britain in these secretive groups that were actually maybe inspired by
older types of conspiracies, like the Bavarian Illuminati. Like, all this stuff is real. But what does it mean? Okay, so you have ideas in phase one. People have ideas. Maybe they're bad ideas. Maybe they're evil ideas. Then phase two, you have implementation, where you round up people usually with good intentions and you try to put something into practice, right? So you say, okay, these are ideas. This is a plan that brings these ideas into reality. And then at the third stage, you have success. So a lot of people, because they don't understand these nuances, is they say, they start with facts, right? And they say, in the 1950s and the 1960s, the government had a program called MKUltra, where they did mind control experiments and they tested LSD on people. Therefore, we're all mind controlled. Right? You skipped everything.
Sense.
You skipped everything.
Yeah.
Yes, that is true. The government had a program called MKUltra. Okay, then you skipped everything that happened since then, and we are all under mind control. Now, that was an idea. Was there an implementation for that idea? Yes, it was implemented. Money was put into it. Projects were run. Experiments were conducted. LSD was involved. Did it work? No, I don't know. Is everyone mind controlled? And this was real, right down to the rationalization was, could we use it as subversion in the Soviet Union if we put LSD in the water? Those were questions that were asked, you know? There's a lot of truth to a lot of these conspiracies that when you say, have you ever heard of the government mind control project? You know, you sound like a fruit, right? But it's real. But what does that mean? Just because it's real, just because it was an idea that a group of people had, does it mean that it went into practice and that it was successful? You know, were there people ever, and I don't know the answer to this because I've done no research on the subject, who said, we could use vaccines to reduce population? Maybe. But that doesn't mean that that's what vaccines do today when you inject them in every case, you know? So one of the things that I try to evaluate when I'm trying to judge the validity of a conspiracy theory that's presented to me is, what's the approach a person uses? Because Stefan Molyneux often says, you know, like, use moral arguments because it saves you time doing research. Just say, oh, will you use force against me to get this thing that you want? And I've called it skip to the gun. You know, when people tell me about how great this government program is going to be, I just say, okay, well, let's forget all that. Let's skip to the part where someone points a gun at me if I won't do it. Does that happen? You know, another approach, besides making moral arguments, which I don't totally disagree with, but I understand that it can be very volatile. You know, there's a lot of volatility in these conversations already, and that can push people over the edge if you're making moral judgments, or they perceive that you're making moral judgments about them. But the other approach is to look at what are someone's methods for trying to present new ideas. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think we've talked about Alex Jones in all three shows now. Okay, but what Alex Jones does is when you overwhelm people with and all that stuff he says, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 facts. Could all be true, but they don't necessarily force that conclusion, right? And because he's not giving you enough information, he's not giving you a context of how they relate together. Because you say, okay, wait, stop, let's go through them one by one. That can't happen. You know, that never happens on the radio, right? That's not the format of radio. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, it almost makes me think that this is sort of the problems with, you know, the emergence of blogs and all these short things that we read. We read the short story and we want to get to the point. We don't really want to have a deep analysis and we don't want to read a book on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so as a result, we skip all these parts. And you can come out with a lot of faulty conclusions from doing that.
Right, right.
And when you want just, you know, the pure facts, the pure documents, well, you're still not skipping a lot of relations that those different ideas can have.
Yeah.
So.
And another thing, you brought up the fact that there is a lot of fodder there to kind of talk about conspiracy theories. I mean, if the government doesn't want conspiracy theories, they should stop doing so much creepy shit, like Operation Northwoods. Because look at Operation Northwoods, where it's like, okay, we're going to fake attacks by Cuba and kill American citizens in Miami in order for us to be able to start a war. It's like, Alex Jones does have that document.
Right. And supposedly the story is Kennedy. He looked at that and he said, no, I don't think we're going to do this. Maybe it was because, no, this is too dangerous. What if we get caught? You know?
Yeah.
Or this is un-American. Like, you could still, even though you're working in a very sort of pragmatic and realpolitik kind of way, you could say, oh, this is kind of like, we shouldn't do this. I would feel something. I don't know. I'm only speculating. But Kennedy said no. And the guy who proposed it was fired. So the idea that, well, we're running this concurrently secretive operation called Northwoods. And these are the highlights of what it is. He presents it like that, and that's not true, right? So there's an element of truth to that story, but it doesn't mean, oh, 9/11 was an inside job. Whether it was or not, it doesn't. You can't say 9/11 was an inside job because Operation Northwoods. 9/11 was an inside job because Hitler bombed the Reichstag building in Germany in the 30s, right? Now, I understand that I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush and make Alex Jones sound less nuanced than he actually is. But I heard him on that that Coast to Coast show like in 2005, and it was a debate. And that was how he led. He said, we have Hitler firebombing his own Reichstag. We have Operation Northwoods. As if that's building up to his conclusion, and it's not. Those might be like somewhat related ideas.
But those are entirely unrelated events.
Right.
Yeah.
So again, it's skipping the process of a conspiracy. Conspiracy is real. History is filled with conspiracies. You know, people have... it wasn't Spooner. Buckminster Fuller. Government is the ultimate conspiracy. I think it was called the Grunch. I forget what that's... It's an acronym for something. But government as the ultimate conspiracy. The Federal Reserve. You know, the... all of, and even the collusion between corporations against the government, like during the New Deal, all fit the definition of conspiracy. Like in it, history is like people conspiring together and people finding out about it and reacting. You know, so the idea that people immediately dismiss this stuff, I think, is wrong. But
do you think that it's kind of a bad setup from the get go if you're going to set up a conspiracy for a skeptic debate because it's I guess it makes it so that you pick a certain side, because I guess if you're the skeptic, you're not supposed to state like, yes, Operation Northwoods is brought up or those kind of things.
Well, you know, I mean, we talked before, like I'm an atheist, right? But I when did atheism become the religion of Richard Dawkins? You know what I mean? So it just becomes this like, again, that movement thing takes over and this groupthink approach. And I'm not saying that atheist is that for everybody, but there is a contingent within the umbrella term atheism that just goes around to eat whatever out of Richard Dawkins' hands or Sam Harris's hands.
For a long time, we were a part of that, I think, for sure. And we were very excited about the atheist movement and the secular movement. You know, and that sort of groupthink does take over. Yeah, I've seen it take over.
In 4 years, I used the term atheist movement like a billion times.
Yeah.
So related to that, the skeptics movement is like some, oh, I'm a skeptic, so...
I'm going to question what you're about to say.
But I feel like people are doing that, and maybe there's isolated examples of being irresponsible with the idea of skepticism, like people who will argue against any conspiracy with minimal research. And what they'll do is like, who's the guy? I mean, I think he worked for Reason for a while, and I generally liked what he did. And he, I can't think of his name, but he did a lot of these like 9/11 things, right? And he went to experts and said, yeah, give me stuff. Like, what'd you guys write? A Popular Mechanics article? I'll use that, right? So really didn't do the due diligence of skepticism, right? Because it's very hard to do fully, because you can't be like, 9/11 is such a clusterfuck because people threw everything from every single possible angle that you could never, you know, tear that web down because it's so complex, right? So I just felt like a lot of the people, though, who tried to go after and take the conspiracy apart really hadn't done their own research. And they say, I'm a skeptic, this is my position, right? And there's a lot of people who are saying, I'm a Catholic, so this is my stance on that. And I'm not saying it's the same, but I'm saying there's a lot of skeptics who are not doing the work.
Well, and the shitty thing from the get-go is stating that conspiracy theorists aren't skeptics in any way. You know what I mean?
Right. Like
there is that issue, because I think conspiracy theorists are skeptical of the main statements that individuals are making. They're skeptical of the government. They're skeptical of people who are for coercion, or at least some of them are.
Yeah, no shit, right? I mean, like, go and read cop blogs, like that the cops talk to each other on. Go read Jack Abramoff's book and figure out who's conspiring against you for real every day, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I like that you say, you know, people do conspire together. That's something that happens. It's something that can happen on a daily basis. It doesn't have to be necessarily involved in the government. It happens in human interactions all the time, conspiring to do something. You know, but unfortunately, the word conspiracy has become a really, it has a, it's a derogatory term. almost to at this point.
To dismiss something.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, Noam Chomsky, who's an expert on language, certainly, and very understanding of the power of language in media and politics, pointed out when I used to listen to, I mean, I was into him a while ago, you know, long years ago. And he said, conspiracy is a word we use to as a shorthand for I don't want to think about it.
But then conspiracy theorists then use that that statement in order to then follow up with, therefore, 9/11.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there is the I understand that argument, but it's also like, therefore, the people who are conspiracy theorists are the ones who were the ones who were questioning, and you're not the one. You know what I mean?
But what Taryn has said has been incredibly successful, because people, you know, you say something that's just out of the, just slightly out of what's been, you know, approved for mainstream thought. And they say, oh, is this like the Elvis Lives kind of? Is this like an Area 51 thing? Is this like the underground aliens thing? You know, I mean, they do. It's all shorthand for, I'm very uncomfortable with your new information. So you're either stupid or crazy. There,
yeah.
I'm done.
Yeah.
You know? and we deal with that all the time. And I would like to see more empathy from, I mean, even though I think that skeptics, conspiracy theorists, I don't like those labels, but I think that debate, that is discussion, is not only entertaining, but it's a good discussion to have. People should be more empathetic to people who might have some of these more far out theories or these research projects that they do, and just be like, oh, what a waste of time. You know, this is what you're working on. Well, you know, that's interesting to some people. You know what I mean? And it can also be like, I came to this through 9/11 truth and all kinds of other, you know, stuff that's far wackier to the mainstream than that. And that can be, like, just as it is with education. What motivates people to want to learn new stuff? And where can that take them? So people want to do 9/11, you know, loose change and Alex Jones? Great. Let's see where it will take you. But will it just take you into a place where you're, you know, angry and resentful towards everyone, and you isolate and you're, you know, stockpiling cans and, you know, pointing guns at your neighbors and, you know, like that kind of, that's not good. And, you know, I mean, maybe it's kind of like what I always say about money, alcohol, and hallucinogenics, right? Like whatever road you're on kind of spiritually, emotionally,
it'll
those
take you there
things
quicker.
Are just going to, it's like an accelerator on that road. Like you'll just get there quicker. You know, it's not going to turn you around. So, you know, maybe Alex Jones, we're using Alex Jones as kind of like a category here, I think, not specifically Alex Jones. So, but just as that general category, for some people, maybe that's really good because they say, wow, if this is true, the world is vastly different than I ever could have imagined or what I was ever told by television or in government school. I'm going to go investigate. But for people who have this propensity towards anger and resentment and paranoia, that's the worst thing that they could find.
Yeah, it can be really destructive. But I think you're right. We need to be more empathetic to individuals who are seeking out these ideas, even if we think it's pretty far off, right? Mm-hmm. Doing our own research. Because if we're not, then it closes the door to open communication and discussion and exchanging ideas.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, Jeff, you want to be in this?
Sure.
Yeah, pull up a chair.
Come on, get in here, sir.
Ed, should we talk about the beauties of unschooling? Or not even unschooling. You're not even unschooled. I feel like you just travel and you learn on your own.
I guess
you are exceptionally independent for your age.
Jeff, how do you feel about being 15 and being given all this information in regards to anarcho-capitalism and taking it and relishing with it?
Well, it's not just anarcho-capitalism, it's philosophy and self-knowledge, able to really look through, I guess, the delusions that's been implanted on you through your early childhood and removing yourself from that. So, and one of those would be anarcho-capitalism, one of those delusions. And so, I mean, not anarcho-capitalism, I mean, the government would be one of those delusions. And anarcho-capitalism is one of those discoveries through self-knowledge that I have found. I mean, I think it's a very marvelous and unique, uncharted territory that I'm trekking through.
Yeah.
How do your parents feel in regards to your constant travels? Because I think it's great what you're doing, but I know so many paranoid, and you discuss it a lot, helicopter parents.
Yeah.
Who would be frankly freaking the fuck out if their kid was going around anywhere discussing these ideas with people. So how do you feel?
Well, they've always kind of left me, I guess, explore the world a little more. They never really, I guess, gave into the kind of that the world's an evil place for the most part. I mean, sometimes I guess they still kind of do that, but they're really freedom, I guess, minded in that way. And so I think they trust me and they trust my, I guess, judgment, allow me to explore and find good people. You know, I guess a lot of this trip that I've been doing so far has been unplanned from the original point, and I had to really make my own plans and find out places to stay and stuff like that. So I've been doing a lot of it on my own and figuring out, I guess, communication skills and stuff like that.
That's so great.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's awesome. Really.
That's cool as hell. Jeff has been staying at our hotel, which...
thank you.
Happy enough to sleep on the floor, which was...
Yes, thank you so much for the floor to sleep on.
Well, yes.
And the yoga mat.
And the yoga mat.
Sometimes it seems like we learn more from you than you do from us, so it's a pleasure. It's good.
Yeah,
this is your first time at Porkfest, right?
Yeah.
What has your experience been like?
It's been a lot of just wandering around, looking at stuff, trying to figure everything out, and then just like about 6-hour conversations with people. It's been really awesome. I'm having a great time.
Can you tell us the coolest thing you've seen and the craziest? I know those are really general, but I'd be interested.
The craziest? Oh, there's lots of crazy stuff going on at Porkfest.
What can you say without Child Protective Services being called on? Is really the question here. Nothing at all, actually. Yeah. Every single thing will have Child Protective Services called in on me.
So... this is the fourth time I've been here.
Yeah.
And this is a nice, this year has been really like a nice balance of, you know, everything like that was good in the past is like this seems to have just like a nice, feel to it. You know, like there was a couple things in the past that were problematic. And then every year that I've been here, they seem to learn and do a little bit better job, even though, you know, it's not always consistent with who's organizing it. Right. Mm. So, the organizers change, but they still seem to, from my experience anyway, inherit the lessons of the past. And it's gotten better, you know, every year that I've been here.
Have you been, are you comfortable with the amount of, say, guns, alcohol, and drugs all kind of combined into one area?
I've never really been like a gun person. Like, I just don't, not really interested in guns. And I know that's something that I'm probably going to have to work out and, you know, get interested and learn how to use one. And I think that's really, really important. And I really, I think that in my life so far, like self-sufficiency, which that is a huge part of, has been kind of undervalued. And realizing that life might not always be this easy and start preparing for that, including obviously, you know, one of the most important elements of that, self-defense. But I've never really, I mean, it's interesting to be completely honest because of the conditioning that we have about just these impulsive reactions to seeing people who don't have costumes on carrying guns. You know, and it's subtle. And I think it's kind of like, obviously, the more I've seen it, the first time I saw it. Yeah. It wasn't like scary, but it was, I noticed it.
Yeah.
You know, because like when I came here in 2010, I had almost never seen, even growing up most of my life in New Hampshire, I'd never seen a civilian open carrying a gun.
Mm. Well.
You know, so it was either Liberty Forum 2010 or this event 2010 where I started to see it. And yeah, you notice it. But then, like, after a day, you don't. Like, so I'm comfortable with it.
Do you think sometimes it's dependent on the person and their stature and what they look like? Because you do see the cop lot guys, and they're pretty big dudes, you know? So, I mean, I made the joke of, oh, well, if I win one of your guns, I'm going to take it through the airport dressed in a dress and heels, and it's going to look. No one would ever expect someone who's 5'2" to carry something that massive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so do you think sometimes it's also we have these preconceived notions about how people, because of their size, or the way that they look, and that's why there's an intimidation sort of belief that goes through our head?
I think there's an intimidation whenever you see in a semi-automatic rifle on someone's back who has a bulletproof vest on.
Okay.
I think there's going to be a little bit of intimidation.
Do you think any person whatsoever?
Probably. I mean, I'd probably even be more worried if they're 8, though.
Because sometimes I wonder if that has something to do with it. If we look at massive people and we think, my gosh, they must be aggressive. They have beards and they're twice my size. You know, we just have this idea that they're going to be violent, which isn't the case.
That's why whenever I become kind of aggressive, especially, you know, in kind of an argument or something, which I obviously am prone to do, I have to remind myself, am I that... they may assume that I'm going to hit them. you know, because I'm a big guy. I'm 6'2" and I'm 200 pounds, and I got to kind of keep that in mind whenever I do that. Outside of the gun thing, just that kind of thing has to be kept in mind in regards to that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is actually the first time I've really seen anybody be around open carrying. And I guess you do mention a good point that's, I guess, mixed in with all these drugs and alcohol and stuff like that. But for me, even the guy with the bulletproof vest and the AR-15 on the back, I mean, I've never really been that into guns and stuff like that, but it didn't really bother me. I think it's a little overdone, especially when you're around a bunch of freedom-minded people who aren't going to aggress against you, but I don't really mind it. I mean, yeah, that could have been a really, I guess, maybe bad situation combining the guns and drugs together, and maybe I think I don't advise to do it, but even here, when you remove all the laws, when you don't really have all those stressors and stuff like that, and those, I guess, people are trying to get criminals and even make criminals, we haven't had any instances here. There's been no shootings, no misfirings or anything like that. So I guess, I mean, I don't know, at least why I'm here, I don't know the history of Porkfest that well, but I know at least here, while I've been here, there hasn't been any instances like that. So it's been very, very safe.
Mm-hmm. It's been the opposite of the movie The Purge.
Larkin Rose pointed out.
Yeah, Larkin Rose did pretty good. I remember, and I'm sure most people, if they have a television or a computer, I've seen commercials for that Purge movie, which was the biggest. I the conspiracy thing, like, it hits in my head where I'm like, the government had to have created this piece of shit. Because it was like, oh, well, one day out of the year, we don't have a government. Everyone continues to kill each other. And Larkin Rose pointed out, he's like, I don't see any cops over here. And we're petting dogs and hanging out. And we're having beer and no one's fond
of it. Yeah, I think there's an important distinction, though, too, is that there's kind of a grounding in some consistent, like, you know, universalizable ethics and philosophy in this group that isn't even 100% consistent, because people here believe different things. Some people, dare I say, might even be here for the wrong reasons. You said somebody came up to you and said, where are the drugs at?
Yeah.
Or something like that. Where are we? And confuse libertarianism or you know, anarcho-capitalism, whatever you want to call it, they confuse it with libertinism, which is like, I can do whatever I want and there's no rules. I think that's really the wrong idea, and I think that's a lot of what was discussed in this etiquette panel that I went to this morning, right? Where this doesn't mean no rules. It's the opposite of that. Like here, actually having rules and following them consistently and applying them consistently is very, very important.
Well, there are social norms, you know, and to just defy those social norms is going to be against your best interest. Yeah, but I mean, libertinism in terms of putting what substances you want in your own body, as long as you're not harming anyone else.
Well, we can look at it.
That's against the movement.
That's totally fine. It's like that's not what it's about.
Right. Okay, that's not the primary purpose.
We can look at another kind of festival and see one where there's not quite that moral backdropping, which is the Juggalo Insane Clown Posse festival. Where I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I've seen that. There's a documentary that I've seen.
Yeah, it's a number of individuals who are fans of Insane Clown Posse have a festival every single year, and there tends to be a lot of violence.
Oh, really? See, in the documentary, it wasn't clear that there was a lot of violence, because like when I see, and I don't mean to, you know, I should know better than to like look at a group of people and judge them, but I see one of those, like I saw like the people who are there, and I was like, oh, if there's 1,000 people there, there must be like 400 murders.
No, not that massive of violence. Well, I mean like fist fights and a few rape incidences.
Okay, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, which I guess you're going to find. But I was listening to some, he was a comedian, he was with his friend, and they were all kind of driving through the thing and everything else, and they kept on having large soda cans being thrown directly at their skulls, and one of the guys got concussed and was bleeding everyone. He was like, it happens sometimes. People hit each other with, people will knock each other's heads open on occasion. That might have been propagandistic or something, but I felt like that was a different worldview all set together without the law. And do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so if you don't have that kind of a moral backdropping or similar ethical system, then you're going to end up with different results.
It's also something that, you know, obviously has more dangers because it's built around the followership of something else.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's okay that this means different things to different people as long as some just basic principles are adhered to. It's not a cult of personality. There's no leadership. There's no one specific. I mean, there are people who you can look up to. There are people who are considered like intellectual or activist leaders, but it's not built around a person or a personality, like Insane Clown Posse. which is just terrifying to me. But I was surprised to learn. I assumed that those kinds of gatherings would be much more violent than they actually were.
Yeah.
And
You have another case though. Example that went to my head right now: 1999 Woodstock. When
That got really violent. Actually,
that got absolutely insane.
So the original, in 1969, when people went to Woodstock, New York, the message was anti-war. Let's come together and strive for peace. The message in Woodstock 1999 was 30 years ago, a bunch of people came here and did a ton of drugs.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So come back and we'll celebrate that. And what the original, look at the bands that played.
Limp Bizkit was the one that was actually yelling fuck shit up repeatedly to a bunch of people who were dehydrated. But it was interesting the way though that it was set up. Like they didn't allow anyone to bring in liquids. They're charging like $5 for a bottle of water. There was like an $8 ATM fee, and all these things kind of riled up in a number of individuals who weren't there for a moral reason. They're just there to get fucked up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was a disaster waiting to happen. You would think that like a basic understanding in psychology would be like, well, why did even, all the problems that they had at Woodstock in 1969, which believe it or not, probably included maybe some instances of rape or assault or other property crime. As much as people there cared to report property crime. I know that was probably a wide variety of people who attended that. As far as where they came from, I think they had some similarities as to what brought them there. But it was a huge number of people that went there. So when you take away a unifying idea that is about non-aggression, which you could say Woodstock 1969 was, and you just say, well, now this is about seeing how fucked up you can get. You memorialize that event by the fact that people also did drugs there.
And now it's based on new designer drugs that are even more intense. Yeah.
Yeah. And fires.
Yeah.
And a number of other kind of, it's like the chaotic drug sex capade is kind of how they put it all together. Which, it's a totally valid point there. So as long as you have kind of an ethical backdrop, then things like this can work out quite a bit more, which kind of is broader to the whole, like, if the government were turned off tomorrow, would we be in absolute libertopia kind of thing? It's like, no, not necessarily, because there is really no state. It's just a bunch of people acting in kind of a statist manner. And the philosophy of violence that is ever present in the United States wouldn't necessarily go away immediately.
No, because there are still violent individuals and nonviolent individuals who are coexisting on the same planet.
I'm not afraid to say, and I'll probably take a lot of shit for this, but if the state went away tomorrow, it would be Woodstock 99. I think initially that it would be. Now, obviously, that's not a sustainable pattern of human behavior. So people do have need for belonging. People do have need for connection. They have need for safety and security. And after a decompression period, I think that in the total absence of the state, people would have to return to their natural way of being. And I've using the work of people like Robert Higgs, tried to research how the state came to be, and that some of these people just had a super comparative advantage on violence. We go out and we hunt and we've got the spears, and so when we come home, we'll be in charge.
Yeah.
That's a very simplistic retelling of Robert Higgs' research, but that eventually people realized that if they were the ones who went out and did violence and were desensitized to violence against animals, not that I'm making any kind of animal rights argument, it was an easy translation to habituated to violence, to use their comparative advantage in violence to rule over other people. And, we're told this story about the evolution of the species from, being hunter-gatherers to the agricultural revolution, as if everybody came to that at once. Well, the truth is, or what anthropology shows, is that that was happening, obviously. I mean, we know it wasn't like one day somebody got on like a blowhorn. It's like, farming, everybody, farming now. But there's a lot of research that suggests that certain groups of hunters were hunting settled human beings because they had figured out, these people just put all their shit in one place and we have spears.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, those individuals are vulnerable. Yeah.
Well, also talking about the state and saying that it's, if you remove the state tomorrow and everything will be perfect anarchy or it'll be an anarcho-capitalist society, you're simply denying the detrimental effect that the state has on society. Because you don't just traumatize or, I mean, a whole, I guess, humanity and expect them to function perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned, Brett, about people wanting to feel secure and safe and to belong. Well, where do people derive a lot of their security or their sense of safety from or their sense of belonging? They derive it from patriotism and nationality in the state.
Mm-hmm.
So if the state were to collapse, I think that, yeah, a lot of people would be traumatized.
And I really don't believe that the state is the, you know, it's like, I get frustrated sometimes when people say, oh, yeah, this, and this is wrong because of the state. I mean, I see the state as it exists today and as it has for the last few thousand years as a symptom of things human beings haven't figured out how to get right yet.
Yeah.
You know? So the idea of evolution is very appealing, of evolutions, you know, societal or however you want to characterize it, is very appealing to me because it wasn't like, yeah, like sometimes there's these arguments that have been made, and I've made them in the past, and they may be true, but I think it's missing the big picture. There was a tremendous amount of human achievement from as far as new advancements and labor-saving devices from like 4000 BC to maybe like 2000 BC. And there's a really good book about this called Man Makes Himself, written by, I think he was an anthropologist. He could have been an archaeologist, but anthropologist makes more sense. I forget his name. The book is called Man Makes Himself. And around 2000 BC, human ingenuity seems to stop almost for a period of about 2,000 years. Despite some nice achievements like the pyramids, you know, there's almost nothing, and I know I don't have the dates quite right, but there's, as the Egyptian Empire grows, there seems to be, compared to the, you know, the millennia that came before, almost no human progress as far as labor-saving devices, which is all you could really measure human progress with, you know, like the cities, what kind of cities did people live in, and what kind of labor-saving devices that they were inventing. And with the rise of the Egyptian Empire, either people had no incentive to create anything, because if they did, it would be taken away from them, or people had no incentive to create anything because they could just take whatever they wanted. You know, so there was no need to save labor, because what's one of the biggest features of the Egyptian you know, story from 2500 BC to
slavery,
right? So, and that is, for me, that really, in many ways, it's not, you can't pinpoint it on Egypt, but that is really the birth of the state, you know? And then it was all just, ever since then, the evolution of government, if you want to call it that, is how to water down slavery, right? So, like, you can live to be 17 building some guy's cemetery, and that's the purpose of your life. Well, that's probably not sustainable over a course of like several centuries. Sooner or later, people are going to be like, this is kind of bullshit, you know, that I'll live to be 18 dragging rocks around so this guy who claims to be magical can be buried here. Gradually, and then like the condition of slaves improves greatly in Rome. And then, I mean, obviously slavery exists all over the world right up to today, but I'm just hitting some of the highlights here. American slavery is vastly different from place to place, where it is tremendously oppressive, like whether I forget what they're farming, whether it was cotton or tobacco, but for some reason the planters needed it to make it work. It was awful, 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 and they didn't care if people lived or died. They were in the fields all day. But in other places, there was different kind of slavery based on agricultural needs that was not, I mean, it's never good, but it was far less severe.
And again, it's kind of what was Stefan Molyneux's YouTube video? The
Story of Your Enslavement.
Story of Your Enslavement, where he kind of explains that, which was slightly conspiratorial on a like tilt, but it was essentially explaining that the kind of slavery that we have has become more and more advanced only in its the the way, the cultural motif, as in the state has kind of figured out that, or individuals working within the state have figured out that if you allow individuals to be free or certain, give them a certain amount of freedom, then they'll be able to have enough technological progress and profit productivity, which will skyrocket, which will then give the state more and more, which is why the free market or the remnants of the free market have allowed for one of the most brutal countries in the history of the world, because it's given them so much productivity in the weapons department.
Think about how translatable that is, though, to things that I totally agree with, right? Like, when education works so much better when people who are the pupils understand that there's value in it for them, right? So, like, a learning experience is so... there's so much more intrinsic motivation, and it's so much more enthusiasm generally, and such a more positive outcome educationally if you can show a person the value that's in it for them. Or they can even, through their own discovery, see the end of that, you know, what often might be a trying process. So, same idea, right? When you just say, yeah, you're a slave, kind of sucks, I'm really special, God's will, that kind of thing, you know? That has a finite life. But I think Stefan Molyneux made a really good point where if you let people, like the buy into society and the free range citizenship was, sent human productivity through the roof.
Yeah.
You know? And there never been... the last 150 years, I mean, there's no reason why all of that stuff couldn't have happened 1,000 years ago.
Well, I think technically the reason why there was so much more productivity is that we saw us being freer, and that kind of allowed it. But the fact that people are, I mean, consistently have been being less abused, allowing to be more intelligent, more empathetic, more critical thinking human beings. Mm-hmm. And recently we've had a great, explosion of that, even though it still needs more progress in the area. But it definitely has been improving, I guess, more rapidly than before. And that's why we have seen more productivity. And the people often like to say that the reason why we're really productive now is because of technology. It's just like a snowball effect. But that doesn't really make any sense. Even in new fields that we've never found out of before, we're progressing really fast. And that's just because human beings at large are a lot smarter, you know, critical thinking and more empathetic and better human beings overall.
Yeah, but again, going back to what you're saying in regards to things just suddenly stopping, you know, technologically speaking, just in terms of advancements. I was at Pompeii not too long ago, and we're looking at the city, and they're showing, oh yeah, they had, you know, indoor plumbing, here are the pipes, here are the steam rooms, this is how they did this, they had sliding glass doors, they had, you know, two-story houses, and you're looking at everything they did, and you think, what the fuck happened? This was, you know, thousands of years ago, and suddenly everything ceased to happen, and then you think of...
maybe all the lead in the pipes didn't really help.
But even so, whenever you think of pipes, you think, okay, well, you know, they would, once they figured out that they were being poisoned, people would have continued to have made pipes and have had indoor plumbing.
Was that Vesuvius, the volcano?
Yeah.
Okay, what year was that? Yeah. Do you know?
That's why I bet I was just there and I can't.
I was in Latin a long time ago, so I don't really remember. And that was the only time we studied.
Hold on.
Oh, wait, we would look it up if we had
Wi-Fi. Mount Vesuvius, anyone know the year? Mount Vesuvius?
Our studio audience did not have an answer.
But,
But
you look at that and then you think, well, what happened in the, like, Middle Ages? Suddenly people are boiling water outside and bringing it back into their homes, and suddenly people don't have indoor plumbing.
Yeah, that was, you know, one of those weird technological drops.
Fall-offs, or things just pause for quite a long period of time.
I don't mean to... this isn't a knock against religion, but a big part of that was the spread of Christianity, and not the ideas, like not the philosophy of Jesus Christ, who seems like, you know, if that was all real, pretty decent guy, pretty good philosophy. It was the way, the power that that had over people, you know, and you know, the Dark Ages after the Roman Empire went on longer than people think. I mean, it's typically given 476 AD is like the official end of the empire, but there's an Eastern Empire that becomes...
Yeah, people were starving in the city, and then others began to come back in and build it back up. But anyway, beyond that.
When Europe enters the Dark Ages, there are real questions about the entire knowledge of the world, because of the control of the church, the entire prior knowledge of the world, Roman Empire, ancient Greece, Egypt, could have been destroyed. Could have been completely destroyed. I mean, you talk about these libraries that were just burned. Everything in them was just burned and destroyed. You know, not as I don't think it's some conspiracy, but just by vandals. And
you can see, like, even my gosh, Rome. I mean, you look at the Colosseum and you say, oh, okay, yeah, they took everything from it, all of the pieces, to a lot of it went to the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, given a lot of it was when people were starving, trying to build things back up, and so they were just taking whatever materials they could, but a lot of it went to the church as well. So, yeah, I think religious hierarchical structures have a deep impact on society.
And looking at which religions were also producing a lot of the new advances as far as legal systems go and science was actually the Islamic societies. Like 9th to 11th century, around then, there was a lot of movement as far as these Islamic leagues and groups, which, of course, it's kind of backwards now.
It's hard to, yeah, I mean, it's the question, I think, and it's hard because I looked for patterns between, like, the, when Islam was a very just hot topic, you know, so
yeah,
5 or 6 years ago when I was teaching history. I looked for consistencies between Christianity and Islam and how they had played out over the course of hundreds of years.
Yeah.
At this point, both over 1,000 years. And the working theory that I had that I couldn't prove, but it's worth mentioning, was that as a religion sinks its teeth, or not the religion itself, but the way the religion can be used, like I said before, into an enlightened culture, they have to fight that off, that ball and chain, they have to escape it. As the religion sinks its teeth in, then the culture, the enlightened culture, has to, like, break back through and escape. So if you look at a lot of the example that I gave was, if you look at the Islamic world today in places like maybe Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan, it looks a lot like Massachusetts in the 1600s. And it's funny that Islam is about 300 years younger than Christianity. Right, so there's a natural process of shaking off the religion that a culture has to go through, but the truth is it might not be you. There might not be a model that you can use, right? Like, because I was really into the model, right? And I was really into the predict. I mean, I was kind of like really influenced by behaviorism, and I was like, no, all human behavior, especially in groups, is very predictable, and there's always a reason, and you can find patterns, and you can find connections, and history does provide that in a lot of times. Like you know, those who don't learn from history, that kind of thing. But I could never make that, you know, like really to the point where I was comfortable saying, here's a theory that I, you know, I think is true.
David, when I talked to David Friedman about it, he was bringing up, you know, us trying to find patterns throughout history in order to be able to prove a point. And he brought up the idea of professional libertarians, wherever you get information that contradicts kind of the libertarian motif, every single time a state gets bigger, then everyone gets worse off, then the whole thing collapses. And he brought up that, you know, that's one of the worst things you can do when you're trying to understand more of history, is to automatically try to find a pattern necessarily where there isn't one.
Right. So what I mean, the only thing that I could say is even a generalization, is that when people realize the power that religion had for control of a culture, that's when, you know.
Yeah. No, but, and yeah, and that has been noted. I mean, and there are certain patterns, obviously, as far as religion in many ways being a negative upon a number of different societies throughout history.
Well, we see it presently today. We see the ill effects of it.
Yeah, but we also can see the ill effects of a nation without any form of religion except the state, in the Soviet Union, North Korea.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. I think the ill effects those countries experienced are pretty different from the ones presently. I mean, I think of, you know, religious activists today who are very against stem cell research, for instance, and, you know, preventing scientific progression like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's also obviously the issue in regards to that. That was a lot of information that we just kind of went over in a short amount of time.
Yeah,
very interesting.
Yes, we have to go take some photos for the Porkfest thing. But thank you, Brett and Jeffrey.
Thank you so much.
Check Brett at School Sex Project. You guys know where the hell to go. You probably listened to him before you ever listened to us.
SchoolSexProject.com.
Yeah.
And check out Skeptical Youth on Tumblr.
Thank you.
YouTube.
Yeah. YouTube. Yeah. And we'll try to get more interviews while we're here. And also, stuff will be posted pretty soon. So, okay. So thanks a lot, guys.
All right.
Thank you so much.
You.